You are listening to Chats in Linguistic Diversity, brought to you by Macquarie University and the Language on the Move Network, hosted by Ingrid Piller.
My guest today is Dr. Piers Kelly, an anthropologist and literature researcher at the University of New England in Armidale. Piers's PhD is from the Australian National University in Canberra on Eskayan. Eskayan is a utopian language and script that was created over 100 years ago by a radical prophet in the southern Philippines. Now that sounds super intriguing, but he's also an expert on something even more intriguing, and that's Aboriginal message sticks, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Piers is the creator and editor of the Australian Message Stick Database, a digital repository of more than 1,100 message sticks and their associated metadata. And he's the author of a fascinating new article that has just come out in the Journal of Material Culture. That article is called Australian Message Sticks, Old Questions, New Directions. Welcome, Piers.
Thank you.
Piers, how did you get interested in message sticks?
Well, I heard somebody in Europe give a talk on the undeciphered Linear A script of Crete, and in the talk she mentioned Australian message sticks as a kind of comparative aside, and I thought to myself, well, why don't I know something about this? And this was shortly before I was about to start a postdoc at the Max Planck Institute in Jena in Germany, in a lab that was looking at the evolution of graphic codes of all kinds, and it occurred to me that I was the only Australian at the Institute at that time, and I should bring something Australian to the topic. So when I was back in Canberra, I contacted the National Museum of Australia that has some terrific message sticks. The museum was very helpful, and they agreed to photograph the 50 or so message sticks in their collection at no cost, and this became the basis for the database that you mentioned, and I also got some help from IATSIS. And then back in Germany, I began very slowly developing the database mostly by visiting European museums. And I was surprised at just how many message sticks are in those museums, particularly in Germany and the UK. And I didn't start out with any big questions, just a kind of curiosity to learn a bit more than I did. And it was never really my main project when I was at the Max Planck Institute. I was mostly working on writing systems and the question of how communities that are traditionally non-literate, how they appropriate or reinvent writing systems for their own purposes. And now I'm still interested in that, but I've kind of put that question on pause for a while, and I'm focusing more deliberately on message sticks.
Can you describe a message stick? What actually is it?
It's a hard question because a message stick can look like anything. But a very typical shape, if you like, is if you can imagine a piece of polished wood that's about 20 centimetres long, maybe. It's tapered at one end, and sometimes it's tapered at both ends. It can be more or less flattened, like a ruler, or it can be cigar-shaped, and then it has markings along its surfaces. So the most common markings are simple notches and lines, and you also get dots or stippling, but there can also be quite elaborate and iconic pictures, and some of them are so fine and small that they're only visible if you look very closely in bright light, and that's been my struggle in a museum setting where it's not always possible to get a bright light. So that's the typical shape, a tapered polished stick that's marked with signs. But then there's quite a diversity across Australia. So there's a message stick from Mornington Island in the National Museum of Australia that's a metre and a half long, which is huge. It's painted and it has emu feathers affixed to one end, and a beautiful object. And then in the database, the smallest one is one that I came across in the Pitt Rivers Museum, and it's just over 5 centimetres long. It's tiny, it's wrapped up in possum fur twine, and it's from the Wanyawalku people of western New South Wales. But one of the things I found that complicates the question even further of what a message stick is supposed to look like is the fact that in a tight spot, Aboriginal people could use other things as message sticks. So there's a wonderful example of a spear thrower from Victoria that was repurposed as a message stick. And sadly, it's been lost in a fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so now that we know what they look like or what a typical message stick looks like, what did Aboriginal people do with it? How was it used? What's the purpose? And maybe you can break this up for us in how were these message sticks used in pre-colonial times, how were they used in the late 19th, early 20th century, and how are they used today, or are they still used today?
Well, just quickly answering the last question first, they are still used today in a different way that they were used before. They're certainly used today. But the traditional way that message sticks were used in pre-colonial times follows a kind of set routine that's, in my understanding, is reasonably consistent across Australia, and it goes something like this. So someone wants to send a message to another person or to another community that lives outside of their own territorial jurisdiction. They appoint a messenger, who is usually a man, and then they go off and harvest a small piece of wood, which they then begin carving in the presence of this appointed messenger. And while they're carving it, they explain the content of the intended message and the meaning of individual signs carved on it. For example, it might be, you know, it's time to hunt kangaroos, they're plentiful, we need to coordinate people for the hunt. And so the person who's the sender is making the stick and explaining that's the message. And then the messenger takes the message stick and sets off towards the camp of the intended recipient or recipients. And what's important at this stage is that his identity and his purpose as a messenger is made really clear. So the message stick is displayed publicly. It can be hung on the end of a spear or inside a net bag. It can be tucked in a waist girdle or a headband. There are examples of message sticks, really small ones, that are in fact have been stuck through the nose or through the septum. But the point is that everyone must be able to see it, and the messenger can kind of signal his role through things like body paint as well. And everyone needs to know that he has a message, because there's a strong protocol of, as it were, not shooting the messenger, or not, at least not spearing the messenger, because once he passes into country over which he doesn't have traditional rights of access, he would otherwise be placed in danger of being killed as a trespasser on the spot. So he crosses over a political boundary without harm and approaches the camp of the recipient, and usually sits some distance away so everyone can see him and that he means no harm and that he has this kind of ambassadorial mission, if you like. And then eventually he'll perhaps be given food and invited to approach the camp. And at this point he delivers the message stick to the recipient along with a verbal explanation of what it means as it was conveyed to him by the original sender. This again is all still done very publicly. The recipient might then carve a message stick as a response or simply give a verbal reply which the messenger then takes back home. So that's the kind of classical routine with variants around the place. So some groups did all of that but without a message stick at all. And for them the messenger, for example the Djeri people, South Australia, didn't use message sticks, but they still did that routine, and the messengers, interestingly, for the Djeri were women, always women. Elsewhere in Australia, it's almost always men. Then this routine of the messenger, the sender, the messenger, the recipient, it began to change with the expansion of the colonies. So Aboriginal people began to take advantage of different forms of transport, like horses, carriages, steamers, and so on. The motifs that appeared on message sticks were also influenced by new signs introduced by settlers. There's an example of a message stick with a representation of police stripes and insignias, for example. There's one I saw at the Pitt Rivers Museum that has playing card suits inscribed on it, and this one was in fact once owned by Banjo Patterson, which is an interesting detail. There's a few from the Kimberley region that have intriguing representations of what look like letters of the Roman alphabet. And it's also in this time that there are cases of non-Indigenous people, settlers, learning how to make message sticks and then using them to communicate with Indigenous communities. So it becomes this kind of hybrid technology. And then as the, you know, as the 19th century wears on, it seems more common also for women to be sending message sticks or to be messengers themselves, even in places where women traditionally didn't do that. So the system is getting shaken up by the expanding colonies and it's finding ways to adapt. By the early 20th century, message sticks are no longer widely used in that traditional routine that I outlined before, except in the top end, in places like Arnhem Land, Tiwi Islands, Groot Island, which are places that are very interesting for my research, but it continues there up until, in some places up until the 1970s. Meanwhile, in the rest of Australia, there's the emergence of a new tradition of what I've called artistic message sticks or replicative message sticks, and this tradition coincides with the rise of commercial Indigenous art production. So Indigenous carvers begin making message sticks specifically as objects for sale to settlers. And in some cases they may look similar or even identical to the traditional message sticks, but they're not invested with any communicative meaning. And this is a practice that continues in various forms today. And in fact, a large number of the message sticks in museums come from this tradition. But meanwhile, back in the top end, where the traditional practice was continuing, we get the emergence of yet another practice, which is about using message sticks in very high-profile political negotiations with non-Indigenous institutions. For example, and the earliest example I have of this is a group in the Tiwi Islands sent a message stick to Prime Minister Robert Menzies in 1951. And Indigenous leaders from Aurukun and Mornington Island sent a joint message stick to Prime Minister Gough Whitlam in 1974 to demand land rights. Bob Hawke got one in 1983. There was even a message stick tabled in the Senate in 2007. And last year you might have heard of a guy called Alwyn Doolan, who's an Indigenous man from Queensland. And he walked 8,000 kilometres to deliver three message sticks to Scott Morrison, who in fact refused them, which was kind of extraordinary. So this is a practice, this kind of high-profile political message sticks is still going strong, and it's very much a continuation of these earlier practices where message sticks could sometimes have a very strong diplomatic function. And late 19th century ethnographies talk about message sticks being like a royal seal that authenticates the messenger and his message. And of course, one of the purposes traditionally was to solidify alliances. So that's a strong continuation of that from a part of Australia where the tradition was very strong up until, through the 20th century. What's really different about the contemporary political use of message sticks is that they're always being passed from an Indigenous representative to a non-Indigenous institution. And unlike the traditional routine, the sender and messenger are usually one and the same person. So you make a message stick and you carry it yourself to the Prime Minister or whoever else. So that's an innovation.
That's pretty shocking to hear that the Prime Minister would actually refuse to accept a message stick. Unbelievable, huh?
Yes.
I
was in contact with Alwyn Doolan at the time, and we were coordinating. We were trying to together write something about this, but it was very hard because he had a smartphone. He was on the road for so long. And when he started out his journey, it was before the election. So this is how long his journey was. And he arrived just in time for the results. And so I wonder if it had been Bill Shorten who'd won the election, it might have been a different case. But it was a real missed opportunity, I think.
Yeah, indeed. And that kind of brings us to this question of why do we actually know so little about message sticks, I suppose. I have to tell you, the first I heard about message sticks was like maybe 2 years ago when I saw a tweet of yours about message sticks on Twitter. And I believe this wasn't the first time I actually saw message sticks, because I've been to the Aboriginal collections of a number of the museums that house quite a few message sticks. I've been to the South Australian Museum in Adelaide. I've been to the National Museum of Australia. I've been to the Volkerkunde Museum in Leipzig and in Berlin. So I feel like I must have seen message sticks in museums before your tweet drew my attention to them. And that to me, in a sense, exemplifies that there is something going on with our lack of attention to them. Can you maybe explain to them why we know so little, and also talk a bit about the lenses that have shaped our knowledge about message sticks?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, all those museums are important collections, but even so, you're unlikely to have seen them on display. So they would have been in Leipzig. They've got quite a number of message sticks, but they're all in storage. There's a few of them are on display in the local library in Leipzig, three of them. But at National Museum, I've not seen them on display. South Australian Museum, maybe or maybe not. I'm not sure. So it's one of those curious things about museums, is what you see is only a tiny fraction of what there is. And some of these things will never get seen unless someone asks to see them. They just sit there forever. But yes, I don't really know why there's so little written about message sticks. I was worried when I started out on this research area that maybe they're not that interesting in the end. Maybe that's why. And that's certainly not true, it turns out. And it could have something to do with the fact that I think they don't enter into the historical record, into the kind of public historical record, until the 1870s. And on the whole, settlers just didn't notice that this was going on, that Indigenous people were communicating in this way. And by the time they clocked onto it in the 1880s and the 1890s, message stick communication was already entering into sharp decline across most of Australia. The colonies had expanded almost everywhere. There were, of course, restrictions placed on the movements and activities of Indigenous people. And nonetheless, there was a strong wave of interest in message sticks from the 1880s through to the early 1900s. And this kind of 30-year period is when most of the message sticks in museums today entered the collections. But it's also a period that coincides with the high watermark of social evolutionist theory in Europe and America and Australia, and this idea that all human societies could be ranked on a continuum from, you know, quote-unquote savagery through to quote-unquote civilization. And the aim of archaeological practice and anthropology was to go and look for those diagnostic markers that told you where a given society was on an evolutionary scale. And the most important criterion in this model for attaining civilization was that you had writing. And that was the crowning technology, because it allowed records to be made, and, you know, writing literally brought a society into history, essentially. And Indigenous people around the world were considered to be ahistorical or prehistorical because they didn't have writing. They were timeless, or they were seen as kind of representative of earlier phases of European prehistory. And it's important to recognize that social evolutionism, these ideas were not fringe theories at the time. They were paradigmatic. And even critics of the theory, people like the brilliant black Haitian anthropologist Antonin Firmin, who critiqued the model, he still accepted the premises. He took the premises for granted, many of them. So it was very much hegemonic. And Aboriginal people in Australia in this framework were placed on the lowest rung in that evolutionary scale, on the basis of things like an absence of pottery, an absence of metallurgy, and of course writing. But then a German anthropologist that you may have heard of by the name of Adolf Bastian, he got wind of message sticks in Cooktown when he was there in the 1880s, and it was just as he was about to catch a boat home, And he talks about being so excited that he was debating whether he should miss his steamer in order to kind of find out more about message six. He didn't miss his boat, but he, in the few moments that he had, the few hours he had, he found an Aboriginal trooper who volunteered to make a message six for him and to explain how it worked. And Bastian started thinking, hang on, this looks pretty much like writing. And if that's the case, we really need to rethink what we understand, what we've defined civilization to be. And this preceded a lot of discussion in various scholarly forums about message sticks, what they were. The well-known anthropologist A.W. Howitt sent a questionnaire to settlers all over the country and asked, well, what do you know about message sticks? And then he compiled and summarized the responses, and it led to a debate among settler scholars in a few journals about whether message sticks represented writing. Well, it was framed as a debate, but really the hypothesis that message sticks represented some kind of language, specific language, was always set up as a straw man. You know, well, there are some people out there who maintain the view that message sticks are writing, but this is ludicrous because X, Y, and Z. And the consensus position was really that message sticks were largely meaningless, but all the real information was carried in the verbal exchange. And the message stick was really only a kind of token of authentication, or it was a prompt to help the messenger remember the message. At the same time, though, the very same people like A.W. Howitt and later Walter Ross, admitted that the signs on message six potentially had conventionalized semantic values, and they even went so far as to kind of identify them and gloss these meanings from individual objects. So there was a kind of contradiction at the heart of what settler scholars were doing, and I think it comes down to the fact that they were approaching message six from a very Eurocentric perspective that kind of admitted that the only significant or real graphic code out there was writing, something that modeled the sounds of language. If you did anything else with visual signs, it was just a kind of noise or decoration. And I think this was a missed opportunity, because after having, you know, quote-unquote, solved the question of what message sticks were, then the research energy really waned. And tragically, collectors decided at this point that there was no need to make any effort to consult message stick makers to understand what the objects were intended to mean. And so collecting institutions are filled with message sticks that have ultra-detailed physical descriptions. You know, it's 16.5 centimetres long, it's made out of this kind of species of timber, and here's the Latin name, and it has fine cross-hatching along its transverse dimension. But actually, nothing about who made it and what its intended meaning was, sometimes not even where it's from, or you get a label like Western Australia, which is not very helpful. And this is why I think the very best descriptions of message sticks were made before this prejudice took hold. So settlers and ethnographers like Bastian were open-minded about the possibility, so they recorded much more detail, assuming everything to be relevant. But after deciding that, you know, message sticks were not that interesting because they weren't writing, we get these very extraordinary events cropping up in the archives, in newspapers and so on, accounts of message sticks that are successfully interpreted without a messenger. So there's no verbal messenger, a verbal message that's going alongside them. There are cases of messengers who died on their mission, but the message stick is recovered and then read. A bishop in the Northern Territory even conducted a kind of experiment when he was asked to deliver a message stick with a verbal message from, I think, Darwin to Daly Waters, and he decided, just as an experiment, to withhold the verbal message and just hand over the stick to the recipient. And the recipient of the message stick took it, and he accurately read it, and he correctly read it as a request for headbands and boomerangs, and correctly identified the sender too. And Indigenous people also started sending them through the post, for example. There was one that I love that was sent by an Indigenous soldier serving in World War II, which got intercepted by the military censor, and it was released without censorship as well, which I think is glorious. Of course, no one else would have been able to read it in the censorship office, I assume, let alone not the enemy, whoever that was. So it's clear that these message sticks were doing something communicative. They're not just redundant tokens or prompts for memory. And so I think the short answer to your question of why we know so little about them is, you know, very early on, message stick communication was mischaracterized, which derailed research, and this is why we have unfortunately ended up with so little, I think, in the way of substantial knowledge.
Yeah, it's so sad and such a loss. And do we actually have a chance of ever finding out more about message sticks and their use in pre-colonial times, or do we just need to go and think, oh well, I mean, unfortunately these settlers had the wrong idea, and not only did they not leave us any information, but they also stamped out the practice, and so it's just lost.
No, I think there is a chance. Firstly, there's about 150 or so message sticks that are reasonably well described, where we get some detail about the context, the message. In very rare cases, we get the original transcription of the original language of the verbal message. We know where, we know when, you know, we even have individual motifs that are glossed, in even rarer cases. So that's good. That's one way that we can approach the question. There's also, I mean, some of my work up north is where message sticks were used quite recently, and so there are people alive today who can still make a message stick, who can interpret a message stick, who can talk about message sticks. There's very few. I could probably count them on one hand, and I know of, but this is also an opportunity to get a sense of this traditional use. But as for you know, finding out in pre-colonial, like going back before 1788, that's a challenge. So there are no message sticks really that are recovered from archaeological sites, which is not unusual because Australian climates and soils are not kind to things that are made of wood. There are very few wooden objects that turn up in Australian archaeology, and even fewer that predate colonisation. There's possibly one from a cave in Arnhem Land, but it's perhaps not a message stick. I haven't examined it yet. To turn the clock back before 1788 without recourse to archaeology, my clues that I'm hoping to be able to work on are firstly distribution, so figuring out where message sticks are traditionally used and where they are not. So we do have documentation of groups that absolutely didn't use them. And maps can be powerful because they reveal that way, they reveal patterns that weren't otherwise obvious, so that's something I'm trying to work on now. And connected to that process of figuring out the distribution, I'm looking at words for message stick in various Australian languages, and I've only got about 60 or so far, but I hope that this information will tell us something about, you know, contact and diffusion and inheritance and other wonderful things that historical linguistics can do on that lexical level. And lastly, it's a bit of a moonshot, but I'm looking into oral history. So I've been interviewing senior knowledge holders in the top end about their memories and stories that have been passed down to them. And this history is sometimes quite recent and sometimes potentially quite ancient. And there are terrific stories, but unless there's temporal markers in those stories, it's not always easy to establish whether they relate to pre-colonial or post-colonial events. And I have one story, for example, that involves Macassar Rees interactions. But I really need to work on this further. It's a challenge.
Wow. You've just mentioned that you know, you're looking at different words for message stick in the different Australian languages. And one of the hypotheses that you mentioned in your article is actually that message sticks may also have been used as a means of communication across linguistic boundaries. And I was wondering whether you could maybe tell us a bit more about linguistic diversity and multilingualism in pre-colonial Australia.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting too, because I'm just looking at the words. I've been going back to that recently, and there are words for message stick. They co-lexify often with words for other things, like stick or wood or whatever. But then up in the top end, and parts of the Kimberley and far north Queensland, word for message stick is mark, which is, I'm pretty positive, a borrowing from Creole in parts of Australia where Creole isn't really used so much. So I don't know, I'm just thinking about this. Why would you have a borrowed term, especially in places where the tradition is strong, and it points to this kind of multilingual environment, and also the fact that these are mobile objects. They are moving across territories where different languages are spoken. So it presents another challenge, I think. So we do know message sticks are certainly used across linguistic boundaries to the extent that language boundaries coincided to a greater or lesser degree with political boundaries, so that point where you must not cross unless you have permission. And what interests me is the fact that the original verbal message might have been communicated to the messenger in one language, and then that messenger may have passed on the message to its recipient in another language. And we have to bear in mind, of course, that, you know, as we know, Indigenous communities were and still are highly multilingual. So multilingualism is not and never has been a barrier to communication. On the contrary, languages multiply your capacity for communication and give you a bigger repertoire. Having said that, I'm interested in the extent to which message sticks might have been used as an additional semiotic resource alongside language, alongside things like body paint and gesture. excuse me. And one thing that 19th century ethnographers universally believed was that message sticks had an authenticating function and a mnemonic function. So it authenticated your role as a messenger. It authenticated the message, and it helps you remember what the message was. And I think the authentication is real, but I don't think they really had a mnemonic function, because the messages that we have that are all recorded, that are documented, are all very short. At most, they amount to about 6 lines of text when you write it out. And traditionally, Aboriginal people could and still can recall, you know, song cycles that went all day long. So I think it comes from a literate mentality to assume that we can't remember anything substantial unless it's written down. What I think is more likely is that message sticks are all about mutual reinforcement. So they reinforce and authenticate the oral message, but the oral message also reinforces and authenticates the message stick. So if you're delivering a message into a community with a different language, I can imagine at least that precisely because the message stick motifs are not linked to a specific language, they have the capacity to kind of mutually reinforce a message even across language boundaries. So that's the way I'm thinking about it at the moment, keeping in mind that these are multilingual communities, their resources are there to communicate. But I wonder then, what is a message stick doing when all these other things are available to help channel the message in a particular way?
That brings us really to the million-dollar question. Are message sticks a form of writing, and how are they related to other writing systems?
I think that's a really great question. It's worth revisiting that question, because of course 130 years ago people were asking it, but we can revisit it, I think, from a less Eurocentric or a less literacy-centric perspective. And a standard definition of writing is that it is a system of visual signs that that models some kind of linguistic structure. And usually what it models is phonology. So that's why we talk about writing systems as being phonographic. They're coding for and reproducing salient sounds of language. But a writing system can also sometimes model morphology, excuse me, but in a more limited way. So we can then call that process logographic or morphographic. An ampersand, for example, models the English word and, but it will also stand for counterpart words for and in other languages like und in German or er in French, because it's not latching onto a phonetic signal, it's simply standing in for a word. On the whole, message sticks don't do anything like this. The signs on them convey meaning, but they're not phonographic or logographic on the whole. So two people interpreting the same message stick will not come up with the same form of words. That's how we know that it's not writing. It will not be exactly the same form of words. There are potential logographs on some message sticks. So for example, some message sticks have signatures on them, what amount of signatures that identify the messenger or even the recipient with some specific emblems. There's an amazing message stick from Victoria, sadly lost. We have a sketch of it. It has a rebus on it in the form of a picture of a hand, and the word hand in that language spoken near Warrnambool is munya, which is also the local word for meeting. And this is very much writing according to the strictest definition of it, because, you know, you're drawing attention to the sound of the word by referencing a homophone. But it's clear from commentaries and explanations produced by Aboriginal message stick makers and messengers that this is not a principle that's generally at work in the production of motifs. But if message sticks are not on the whole writing, as we understand the term, then I don't know how to account for these cases where message sticks were interpreted with accuracy without the benefit of a verbal message to gloss it. So there's cases where we don't have a messenger. And this is a central puzzle in my research. I do have a few inklings, though. Firstly, when it comes to the most kind of traditional or classical message sticks, there's only a finite range of things that a message stick can actually be about. Most commonly, it will be an invitation to ceremony. That's the number one message. Young men's initiation or a funeral, for example. These are the kind of the top two ceremonies that involve large groups of people that are communicated about with message sticks. This is right across Australia. Then you get message sticks that are for coordinating hunting. You get declarations of war, requests for political alliances. You get requests for items, especially, you know, tradable or luxury items of value. Sometimes you get a kind of a news bulletin and so on. So if you're seeing a messenger approach, you already perhaps have an idea about what the likely message will be on the basis kind of probabilities. And then the messenger could be painted up in a particular way, so for example, covered in pipe clay for mourning. So that gives you a good guess that it's that is probably about a funeral. I've seen message sticks that have got pipe clay on them with kind of fingerprints of the pipe clay. And so it makes me imagine that the messenger was covered in pipe clay and this is rubbed off onto the stick. Then the message itself will be from a specific named individual to another specific individual. And when you know who that person is and their relationship to the recipient, this again constrains the possible topics. So when my dad calls me and I see his number pop up on my phone, it's often about fixing his computer. You know, I can pretty much guess that as soon as I see his number, that's probably what the topic is going to be. If my brother calls me, well, that topic of communication is less likely. It could be a number of other things. And in Aboriginal Australia, as we know, kinship and social categories can regulate the kinds of things you can talk about as well as the way you're expected to talk about them. There are expectations, in other words, based on the identity of the sender and recipient and their prior relationship. And in many Aboriginal societies, as we know, the whole universe is divided up along kinship or social category lines. So the kind of timber that's selected for the message stick might be meaningful in terms of what it's pointing to in the world, or rather who it's pointing to in the world. And at other times it really means nothing at all. So in some of the field work I did in Arnhem Land, message stick makers have used, for example, wood from paper bark tree. And I asked about this and they say, oh no, it's because it's softwood, it's really easy to work. On another occasion they produced a message stick from salvaged timber because we couldn't get a four-wheel drive. So they found some salvaged timber that was lying around the backyard and probably just an offcut from construction. So the point is with everything I've said so far that even before we get to the science, even before we consider the motifs, there is already a very pretty well constrained frame of reference. When it comes to the signs themselves, they can be quite basic and abstract. So as I mentioned, notches and lines and dots and nothing that jumps out at you as being pregnant with, you know, deep meaning. And they can be quite multivalent too. So a notch is often a person, but it can also be a place. It can be a countable object. It can be an element in a narrative. And a large part of my work is to try to identify signs and meanings and figure out what general class of information is being encoded where. So what's being talked about in the verbal message, what's recorded on the stick, and what's entirely unspoken and implicit in these exchanges. So to sum up, I think a message stick can achieve results that are very like writing without actually being writing. And you could make the case that the signs have to some extent semantic values but not language-specific linguistic values. When it comes to looking at how message sticks relate to other systems, I think it's important to position writing or language-based writing as just one kind of conventionalized visual code that's out there in the world. There are many others like Andean string keepers that are knotted cords once used in the Inca Empire for quite complex accounting and administration. There are lots of symbol systems in West Africa and indigenous North America for recording information, sometimes calendrical, sometimes ritual related. And I'd like to get a sense of where message sticks fit in that whole spectrum. There are those like Elizabeth Hill Boone, who is a brilliant scholar, and she makes the case that we need to come up with a bigger and more inclusive definition of writing. I actually don't agree with it. I think that the definition of writing being a representation of spoken language is a good one. It's well grounded. It's the connotations that we need to challenge. And thinking in terms of decolonization, I worry especially about well-intentioned moves to try to award prestige to a cultural practice on the basis of its underlying or superficial similarity to a Western or European model. And instead I think, you know, let's decolonize the typology itself and decenter writing and literacy as being somehow preeminent, and let's accept and value that there are other ways to communicate with signs, with visual signs that are perfectly adequate for their purpose, and these should be defined on their own terms, not just in relation to writing. So that's the kind of, it's what I think of as the Bruce Pascoe paradox, you know. Mm-hmm. You want to compare, but you also don't want to center the colonial metric, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, these are all such difficult and important questions to discuss, and we could go on all day because this is so fascinating, but I'm very mindful that I've already taken quite a lot of your time. Before I let you go, if someone now who's been listening to this gets really interested and wants to learn more, can you just tell us where can people go if they want to learn more about message sticks, and is there a way for anyone to actually join the research?
Yes, to all of that. Yeah, I think like the best way to start is you can go to the Australian Message Stick Database, just Googling it, and click around. Down the bottom of the screen there's a little map. You can click around. You can find what's in your area from parts of Australia that you're interested in or where you might be from. And if you live in Australia, most towns will have a local cultural centre or keeping place where you might be lucky enough to see a message stick, and you can maybe join locally led, indigenously led research on the ground. At the moment I'm hoping to work with Aboriginal artists from in and around Armidale, New South Wales, to reconstruct traditional techniques for carving message sticks. I'm really looking forward to that. So starting local is always a great idea. And the fact that there hasn't been very much written about message sticks is disappointing, but it's a good thing to the extent that there's very little that you have to read in order to be fully up to date. So I have online, you could find it with Googling it, I think, an annotated PDF called A Very Short Reading Guide to Research on Australian Message Sticks, which is just a beginner's guide to get you started. There's endless topics in this area, so if you're interested in pursuing research topics, I don't hesitate to get directly in touch with me. I can point you further into the right direction, especially if you're perhaps doing a master's topic or an honours topic. I'm very happy to help out there.
Thanks so much, Pierce, and we'll make sure to actually put up all those links together with this particular podcast and make them available. Thank you very much for your time and luck with your research.
Not at all. Thank you very much.